Well, there are several reasons, really. One is that obviously I'm fascinated by Spanish history, and I live here in Madrid, where I'm talking from right now. Secondly, the Spanish Civil War was such a key moment in European history, in the history of anti-fascism, in the history of the build-up to the Second World War, and also in the history of what we can call multinationalism or transnationalism. And then finally, the fact that these 35,000 volunteers, idealistic volunteers who arrived from 80 odd countries around the world, really were a very remarkable phenomenon. And so, fascinating to write about.
Well, your book opens in Barcelona at a little known, I certainly didn't know about it, this sort of counter to Hitler's Berlin Games, this international athletic event. Tell us your choice to start the book there.
Well, 1936 is the year when Hitler is going to have his sort of showpiece Olympic Games to prove that the Aryan race is wonderfully superior to everybody else. And so the left in Spain and in other countries decide that, that there has to be an alternative to that. And those games are arranged to start actually on the 19th of July in 1936. And that is exactly the day when the Spanish Civil War breaks out. And it breaks out because there is a coup or a coup attempt by right-wing reactionary generals. General Francisco Franco, who becomes dictator of Spain eventually, is the most famous of them. And and this coincides exactly with the day that that this alternative Olympics is meant to happen, when there are teams from the United States and elsewhere, and in fact some of the people who are in those teams become the first foreign volunteers to try and defend the Republic, which is a democracy, against General Franco and the generals. And so, it's a very apt place and event to be starting with, because that is where, the very Spanish, very civil war, well, uncivil obviously, but civil in the sense that it's a war between Spaniards, also becomes an international war, because not only will there be lots of volunteers fighting to defend the Spanish Republic and democracy against this attack, but also Hitler and Mussolini become very involved with helping Franco. They send their own troops, their own air units, and these in fact prove to be crucial in the Spanish Civil War.
But what reasoning did Franco have for this coup d'etat? We've seen coups over the years, even most recently here in Myanmar, where the military took made a coup d'etat, basically saying because the democratic government was sort of taking the country in the wrong direction. Did Franco make similar claims?
Yes, well, it's one of those very similar situations where you get a democracy is overthrown by people who claim that the democracy is about to become a sort of left-wing plot against the nation, and that therefore their patriotic duty is to act before that can happen. Obviously, as in Myanmar and other places, it's always a hypothetical situation. They claim that a country is about to be taken over by anti-democratic leftist forces, so they have a coup and it's overtaken by anti-democratic rightist forces instead.
Now the brigaders are drawn from all over the world, as you were mentioning earlier in your remarks. Who are they? Where do they come from primarily? And what are their main motivations?
Well, the International Brigades produce this sort of strange set of parallel narratives where, you know, to the Americans, the International Brigaders are Americans because everybody thinks of the Abraham Lincoln Brigade, which was actually, its proper name was the Abraham Lincoln Battalion. I'm British. In Britain, people tend to think of them as the British Volunteers, and so on and so forth, depending on which country you're coming from. But the truth is they come from, you know, these 80 different countries of today's countries. There were fewer countries in the world in 1936. And mostly they come from Europe. Mostly they come from France, Germany, Italy, Poland. Often they are already people who have been displaced. They're exiles from their home countries, often for political reasons. Germany is already being run by Hitler. Mussolini is in charge in Italy. Most of Europe, of Central and Eastern Europe at least, is being run by right-wing strongmen. The attempts to sort of build democratic institutions across the sort of the remains of the Austro-Hungarian and Ottoman empires in Europe after the First World War have basically failed. And so there are many political exiles as well. And then there are also economic exiles. People, Poland, for example, is a very poor country in 1936, and there are lots of Poles working in car factories or mines in France or in Holland or in Belgium. And so we have this mixture of what I call the displaced and the devout. The devout are those who are very, very politically motivated. Many of them are communists, though the International Brigades are not a communist outfit per se. They're what's known as a popular front or a broad front outfit. So they're open to all the left, but there are a lot of people who are very, ideologically motivated. And in fact, Comintern, the international communist organization based in Moscow, gets involved in order to help organize and recruit.
Now, the Spanish Civil War, in the popular imagination, I guess both at the time and today, sort of evokes these romantic images of the sort of a pure fight of good versus evil in a way that today's conflicts don't. What are your thoughts about that? Why do you think that is?
Well, I think it's because we're in what the historian Eric Hobsbawm called the age of extremes, where you do actually have very strong lines, ideological lines dividing people. The First World War had been ghastly, but it had been about nationalism. So that was, there was a little romance involved in that, in the sense of ideas. It was either you thought it was patriotic to kill or be killed for your country, and so you went to fight in a war. But in this case, it's people volunteering, and this is the key thing about the brigades, volunteering to fight in another country for these sort of romantic ideological reasons. So in that sense, it's a very different war. It's the same anti-fascist war, if you want, that then carries on in the Second World War. So the sort of the lines of good and bad are easier for us to define, especially in retrospect, now that we know what Nazi Germany was really like. We know about the Holocaust and things that hadn't really happened in 1936, but that the people who came to Spain said, we have to come here not just to defend Spanish democracy, but also to fight the global expansion of fascism, which is going to bring terrible things. And those terrible things do eventually happen. And so from our perspective now, we can say, well, gosh, they were right at the time. I have to say, it wasn't like that. And you had to be quite brave in the sense of many people were breaking their own country's laws to come to fight in Spain, because countries like Britain and the United States and many other countries actually prohibited people from fighting in Spain, but, you know, they found ways to get around that.
Let's talk a little bit, Giles Tremlett, about the two forces arrayed against each other. What kind of force did the Spanish Republic, the democracy, have at the time, vis-a-vis Franco's forces? You know, Franco himself was an experienced officer and military commander.
Indeed. I mean, not only was Franco an experienced officer and military commander, but he had most of the established army with him. Most of the army rebelled along with Franco, while on the Republican side had very little of what was left of a professional army and had to arm trade unions and left-wing political parties. Who were not professional soldiers, were not used to organizing an army, and were actually carrying out their own counter-revolution on the Republican side. So things became very confusing. The Republic was always sort of under-armed, more particularly badly organized, and at a huge disadvantage in terms of international aid, because Franco was able to get loans from the sort of international financial system. The Republic wasn't, and also Franco was able to get directly, for example, 2/3 of his air force was directly Nazi or fascist Italian. So the Republic was always at a disadvantage. It got some help from the Soviet Union. Stalin sent advisors. He sold the Republic arms, and then it had the international brigades as well, who were in numerical terms a lot smaller than the forces sent by Mussolini and Hitler together, but were still, you know, a very important and very motivated part of the Republican army.
We're speaking with historian and journalist Giles Tremlett about his new book, The International Brigades, Fascism, Freedom, and the Spanish Civil War. Giles, you were mentioning earlier that the Western democracies, Britain, France, and the U.S., had taken neutral positions. I think FDR even had a neutrality act that he had to abide by, but not so Germany and Italy, the fascist powers of Europe, right?
Yes, well, a rather ghastly organization, which was known as the Non-Intervention Committee, was set up, where everybody agreed not to intervene in Spain, including Hitler and Mussolini, who then simply ignored the pact that they had signed up to. And while the rest of the, you know, the Western world, especially the Western democracies, claimed to be neutral, I would say rather than neutral, it's sort of, it's a kind of aggressive neutrality. By being neutral, they're actually, stymieing the Republic at a time when everybody knows that Hitler and Mussolini are just pretending to abide by the non-intervention agreement. So it's a rather disgraceful phase in the history of Western democracy in the 1930s, and it's really the beginning of what then becomes known as appeasement, the appeasement of Hitler that encourages him to, emboldens him to then go on and grab Austria, to grab parts of Czechoslovakia, and eventually, after the Spanish War is over, to invade Poland and start the Second World War.
What percentage of the Republican officer the Spanish officer corps stayed loyal to the democracy, to the Republic? Do we know?
Well, funnily enough, I've been looking at this over the last few days because I'm working on a biography of Franco. But it's broadly speaking, it's 1 out of 4. We don't have the exact numbers, but 1 in 4 would be probably quite a generous estimate of how many officers remained loyal to the Republic. So that's a sign of just, you know, just how bad things were, and why some of those who arrived with the international brigades or some of the Soviet advisors who arrived were actually much better soldiers or more experienced soldiers, because some of them had fought in the First World War and knew more about soldiering than the people who had to suddenly set up an army in the Republic.
So they were sort of starting off on the back foot, starting off, you know, having to train up a bunch of men who, as you were saying earlier, had no experience. So you're kind of like, you're losing before you start, in a sense, right?
Well, exactly. They were, you can absolutely say that they were losing before they started. The only good thing was that when the coup attempt began, actually, you know, workers in various, in the most important cities here in Madrid or in Barcelona, for example, were able to defeat the army, which itself was very fractured at that stage. And in fact, if it hadn't been for, again, we will go back to Hitler sending aircraft to bring Spain's most effective fighting force, which was the colonial army of Africa, which was based in the Spanish part of Morocco, right in the North African coast, just across the Mediterranean from Spain, and led by Franco. That was flown over by German aircraft, and that then sort of turned the situation around so that the rebels, the right-wing rebels, could then, you know, start fighting a war on conditions of, you know, of great strategic and personnel advantage to themselves.
Because the Spanish Republican government was a coalition government at the time, did that cause any kind of rancor, or was there a lot of disagreement between the ruling parties that, you know, may have prevented them from being more determined or having a fuller plan, shall I say?
Absolutely. There was a lot of disagreement. So, in fact, right from the beginning, when the international brigades are being formed, and because they're sort of being formed under the umbrella of the Communist Party, the socialists who are in charge of the government don't really like them that much. Perhaps more importantly, this is best understood by the events that then happened in Barcelona in May of 1937, where the British writer George Orwell was present. And in fact, it was a major event in his life and in his literary career, because he had joined a Trotskyist outfit that wanted to carry out the revolution before winning the war. That was its sort of order of priorities. Just as the government was trying to, or what remained of the Republican government was basically trying to unite and concentrate on winning the war, and so there was actually fighting on the streets of Barcelona behind the front lines, but between different factions of the Republic. George Orwell was on the losing side of that and sort of saw how the party he supported was sort of turned into, let's call it, a scapegoat for what had happened. And he then turned sort of almost on the spot against Stalinist communism. And that's why we then get books like 1984 or Animal Farm, which are very critical of Soviet-style communism as it was beginning to appear, because we're also talking now just at almost exactly the same time as we're beginning to discover that Stalin is purging people left, right, and center, and is not a very pleasant character. So all this is happening sort of live, shall we say, while the fighting is going on in Spain, and has a huge impact. And in American terms, it's when Ernest Hemingway, who is in Spain as well, who's deeply supportive of the Republic, turns against someone like John Dos Passos, who was also in Spain, because Dos Passos is beginning to say, hang on, you know, there are people here who are beginning to disappear in Barcelona because they're Trotskyists, not Stalinists, and what's going on? And this happens to one of their friends, actually. And Hemingway says, well, you know, that's the way it is. And Dos Passos says, well, if that's the way it is, I'm out of here.
And I guess if you add the anarchists to the mix, you know, who's founding
I haven't even got to the anarchists, but of course they were tremendously important in Spain. In fact, they were the biggest political organization. I wouldn't call them a party because they were anarchists, and they often didn't stand at elections, but they were enormously important as well. And they themselves were split about whether they should be, you know, carrying out the revolution as their main priority or fighting Franco as their main priority. So that was another element to add to the rather explosive mixture that had already been created in Spain.
And also, Giles Tremlett, the Republican forces have been come in for criticism, you know, over the decades since, as sort of having become a proxy for the USSR and for Stalin. Is that a fair criticism, or partly true, or how would you characterize it?
No, that's not actually a fair criticism. I mean, it's only partly true in the sense that they received support from the USSR. They received the military advisors were not huge, but they were very important, even in the International Brigade. In fact, some of the officers were disguised Red Army generals. The senior officers several of them were Red Army generals who happened not to be Russian. A Pole, a couple of Hungarians, for example. But overall, that's not fair. And in fact, you know, one of the feelings about why in the end Stalin sort of basically ran out of enthusiasm for Spain was that internationally, and indeed in the Soviet Union as well, where there were huge demonstrations supporting the Republic, was that actually maybe what was happening in Spain was too ideologically pure, shall we say, and made Stalinist communism look rather bad, and sort of threatened to, you know, to occupy a sort of a space in people's heads about what, you know, the utopia or the ideal of communism or of a left-wing regime would look like. So in that sense, I don't think we can really say that they represented Stalin at all. And indeed, you know, the government was led by socialists, supported by communists, and supported by anarchists. So no, I think that's, you know, that's, it's an argument that is produced and basically repeats the main argument of Franco, that, you know, if Franco and his chums hadn't rebelled, then, you know, then Spain would have become a communist state. And that's not actually true.
Author and historian Giles Tremlett is our guest. The book is The International Brigades. Giles, I was really impressed by the amount of research you put into this. There are scores of pages of footnotes. Let's talk about your research process. How long did it take to gather your information?
Oof. Well, I mean, one can say, give different figures to that. I can look back at my first sort of my first foray into an archive was probably 10 years before the book was published, but that's when the book was just a sort of a dream in my own head. And I was looking in the archives in the National Archives in London to British brigaders. But really for between 4 years of fairly intense research and 2 years of very intense research and writing, you know, I went to archives from Stanford to New York to Amsterdam to various places here in Spain, to Italy, to Warsaw in Poland, and was very fortunate that the main international brigade archive, which is actually in Moscow, was put online just before I started, so I didn't have to spend months and months freezing in Moscow and could just sit at my laptop in Madrid and download the hundreds of thousands of documents that there are there. So it's a very long process, and it's very difficult because, of course, we have, 20 odd languages. The International Brigades were a real tower of Babel. And so, one ends up reading or trying to read documents in languages that, I'm good on Romance languages. I can read Italian and French and Polish and Romanian a bit, but, German and Hungarian and Finnish and Swedish, are all completely strange languages to me. And so I then had to put in had to start a process whereby I basically, scanned documents and books and then put them through automatic translators to try and get a kind of feeling for what they're about, and then found people to properly translate the sections that I thought were relevant.
Now, Giles, earlier in your remarks, you mentioned the names of some of the great artists and intellectuals of the time, Orwell, Hemingway, and also the photographer Robert Capa, cut his teeth in the Spanish Absolutely. Civil War. Let's talk a little bit about this conflict and how this drew so many of the great intellectuals, artists, and thinkers of the time. Why did it become such a cause célèbre?
Well, it became a cause célèbre in the sense that it really was the only opportunity to fight fascism or let's call them fascistic forces. Franco himself wasn't a pure fascist by any means. And I think a lot of people could already see that this was, the beginning of something much bigger. And by something much bigger, I basically mean World War II. And so people, Spain was, let's call it the Vietnam War, indeed the Vietnam, the Iraq War and Afghanistan all and Syria all rolled into one of the moment. It was very, very important. Everybody was watching it. And a lot of people felt profoundly involved in it. I mean, there's the French philosopher Simone Weil, who came and joined a militia unit. And she said, well, I was a pacifist, but I kept watching the war in Spain and I realized, I really felt that there was one side that was right and another side that was wrong. And that sort of obliged me to do something about it. And then lots of the journalists and writers, people like Hemingway, became very personally involved in the issues and in the Republic itself. So, it was very, very important to many people. I mean, I could talk about Willy Brandt, for example, who became the Chancellor of West Germany much later on. Well, he was also here at the time. Nehru, the first, and Indira Gandhi, the first prime ministers of independent India also came. It was a place where because it was a political war where politics was very much in the air continually, and people were very involved and excited, not in the sense of whoopee, isn't it fun, everybody's killing them. Killing each other, but in the sense that that something meaningful is going on, and let's try and work out what it is. And for someone like Hemingway as well, who was seeking inspiration, his literary career was actually flagging a bit, and who liked sort of extreme situations and his sort of infatuation with masculinity and things like that. Well, war and an ideological war was a sort of perfect place for him, and indeed he found the inspiration for Whom the Bell Tolls, which of course is features an American volunteer in Spain, Robert Jordan.
In going through the book, I was really moved by people from all over the world who were from oppressed areas, from fascist occupied countries in Europe, Black Americans, Jews, people who saw this as a, you know, as a way to strike back maybe where they couldn't at home. What do you think about that?
Well, I think it's very significant. I mean, there's, you know, there is a story to be told, which, you know, should be told and is told a bit, but it's probably not as well known as it should be, about, you know, the Jewish response to the forces that will bring the Holocaust. And Jews are proportionally heavily overrepresented in the international brigades. And it doesn't matter whether you're looking at the American volunteers or the British volunteers or the Polish volunteers or the Yugoslav volunteers or the Belgian volunteers. There's always, you know, a relatively huge number of Jews compared to the number of Jews that actually percentage-wise live in those countries. And so you can see there's the sort of the first part of Jewish resistance, armed Jewish resistance to fascism, is happening in Spain. And so that's very key. And in terms of American military history, the fact that in the brigades there were a couple of hundred African-American volunteers, and that they could and did serve as officers commanding white troops, which was impossible in the, you know, in the Jim Crow era of the US, of the US military, and in fact didn't happen in World War II. It didn't happen until the Korean War. So you have this key moment in US military history where Black officers, Black American officers, are commanding white American troops. Oliver Law, who actually commanded the entire Abraham Lincoln Battalion, is one of the best known, you know, figures, but there were plenty more. And at the same time, you have to remember that actually, if you look at the manifestos of, say, of the Communist Party in the Soviet Union in the 1930s, or the communist parties around the world, they're one of the very few outfits that are actually talking about racial equality, for example, actively talking about it and actively promoting it. So you can see elements of, you know, things that to us now seem very ordinary and very acceptable and very just, which then were just simply didn't exist and sort of had their first outing, shall we say, in Spain. And that sort of fits the kind of ideological effervescence, let's say, of the moment.
Yeah, and I was just reminded that the famous American African-American poet Langston Hughes was also in Spain at the time, if I'm not mistaken.
Langston Hughes was here and sent sent dispatches back to a newspaper in, and I can't remember whether it was Philadelphia or where, but he was certainly here as well. So it's, you know, it's all, and Paul Robeson was here.
Wow, I didn't know that. Yeah.
So Paul, you know, so that was another figure, and many, many people remember Paul Robeson because, you know, how amazing to have Paul Robeson sing to you before, you know, while you're sitting in some camp in the countryside in Spain. So yes, he was here too.
And because this is for a US audience, Giles, what can you tell us about the importance of the role of the Abraham Lincoln Brigade? Is there actually a moment where they take part in key battles or anything like that?
Well, the Abraham Lincoln Brigade, because of the sort of the distance basically between the United States and Europe, are one of the last battalions to arrive, along with the British, I have to say. So they miss most of the fighting around Madrid, which is the first bit that the international brigades are involved in. But they arrive at the Battle of Jarama, which is actually part of the defense of Madrid. and then become increasingly important as time goes on within the international brigades as they build up in numbers. And in fact, at one stage, there's actually two American battalions, because there's a Washington, a George Washington battalion as well. And so they are very important, but unfortunately for them, don't get to live the great victories of the international brigades. So they tend to be in the really tough battles where often the Republic is defeated. That doesn't mean that they don't fight well, or that they, or you know, or that they're a poor unit by any means. It just meant that they got the short end of the straw in that sense. But also, one of the aims of the Republic was to try and draw the war out for as long as possible, because they could see that, you know, a Second World War was over the horizon, and their hope was that actually that the Second World War would start before the Spanish War ended, and that suddenly, or, you know, non-intervention would disappear, and that there would be a realignment, and France and Britain would come to help them, and the Americans, and that would change everything. And so the American volunteers became incredibly important in that process of slowing down the Francoist advance. And they fought very bravely, especially in the Battle of the Ebro, which was the last major battle that the brigaders were involved in. So yes, they played a key part, and you know, it was their misfortune to be involved in some of the battles where the Republic lost. They also were in the Battle of Belchite and Quinto, where they actually won. And in fact, I was in Belchite not so long ago, sort of walking through the different parts of what is now still a ruined town, which is where they did some of their best fighting.
Giles Trimlett is our guest. Giles, after the war ends and into after the Second World War and into the Cold War period, many of these Lincoln brigaders would come in for suspicion, right? They would be caught up in the McCarthy period and labeled as communist infiltrators, things like that. What can you tell us about that period?
The post-Second World War period, I think, is fascinating, because you have all these brigaders, many of whom have gone on to fight in the Second World War, because they see their battle as a war against fascism, and that war continues. But they also have problems in some cases, and certainly in the United States, in actually being allowed into the armed services, precisely because they've been in Spain and they're looked at suspiciously as, you know, left-wing radicals. You know, even though at the same time the Allies were quite happy to, you know, to be allied with the Soviet Union, they were worried about, you know, about communist infiltrators, as they would have seen them, you know, within their own ranks. And so some of them do, in fact, especially in the OSS, which is the General Wild Bill Donovan's predecessor to the CIA, they are, you know, they join that because they're actually experienced guerrilla fighters, which is something that you know, that the US Army doesn't have. And then we get a stage after the war where these people want to return to a normal life, and they're looked at often suspiciously as either as communists at a time when, especially as the Cold War takes off, when, you know, communists are being persecuted across the United States, or simply because they're seen as what became known as premature anti-fascists, which was a rather strange expression.
Yes.
So there's this professor, Bernard Knott, who actually becomes a professor of classics at Yale and at Harvard. And after the war, he's had a very distinguished Second World War, where he's been parachuted into Italy and to France to coordinate the resistance movement, where actually international brigades, veterans are very important in Italy and in France and in Yugoslavia and other places. And he wins the Croix de Guerre in France. So, he's got all the best medals, and he's having his interview because he wants to do his doctorate at Yale. And the guy who's interviewing him says, well, why did you get the Croix de Guerre? And he said, he talks him through, how his past in the Spanish Civil War. And the guy looks at him and says, well, you were a premature anti-fascist. And Knox says, well, how can you be a premature anti-fascist? It's like having a premature antidote to poison or something. It's just a ridiculous, a ridiculous expression. That said, and then some of them, fell Alva Bessi, for example, who's one of the Hollywood 10. He was a brigader. But you also actually find that some Soviet spies in the 1950s and 60s in the United States were also brigaders. So, there was some truth, shall we say, to the, to the suspicions that that people had about them. It was a very... even their life after the war was very, very impacted by what had happened in Spain. And my favorite examples are actually in Britain, where you end up with a man called Jack Jones, who became the most powerful trade union leader in Britain. And then on the other side, a man who was a brigader and then called Alfred Sherman, who then sort of changes from being left wing to right wing and becomes Margaret Thatcher's free markets guru. And so these two men were on completely the opposite sides of the argument.
And talk about doing a 180, right?
Totally, in the 1970s, but they would still meet every year at the International Brigades Memorial for their sort of memorial service, because right. Alfred Sherman might have been a free marketeer, but he still believed that the International Brigades had done the right thing, which is interesting as well. And unlike Ronald Reagan, who said that maybe they'd fought on the wrong side, which was bizarre when you think what the other side was.
Well, the brigaders here are starting to finally get their due. There's even a fairly, very moving monument to them on the San Francisco waterfront now. So if you're ever in town, it's worth a look.
Yes, I know. I think it's just been it's just been cleaned up and yes. Reinaugurated. So that's splendid. And is also actually, it's a very nice monument also to the huge number of sailors who joined the International Brigades, not just Americans, but sailors and dockers especially, who had a more kind of international outlook. Given that, even though we think of the International Brigades as these sort of romantic poets and intellectuals, in fact, most of them, 98% of them, were working class men and women, who came to Spain with, their ideals in their suitcase, and one in five of them, we haven't spoken about how many people actually died, but one in five of them didn't make it home. So those monuments are, important.
Agreed. Giles Trimble, let's talk a little bit. You just mentioned it there, the role of women in the brigades. Were they able to overcome the sexism of that period and play vital roles?
No, unfortunately not. This was one area where the sort of, the the ideals of equality didn't really pan out. So, I mean, early in the Spanish Civil War, we talked about Robert Capa, the photographer, who with his girlfriend, whose name has suddenly escaped me, and will come back to me in a minute. Anyway, we're taking many of the great photographs of the early war, where women, militia women, were incredibly important. But unfortunately, in Spain, militia women were withdrawn very quickly from the front. Gerda Taro, of course, is Capa's girlfriend, who dies in Spain while taking photographs at the Battle of Brunete. But women generally, and especially in the international brigades, actually were sort of, they were taken away from the front line and sent to basically work as administrators and doctors or nurses. Those were the principal roles. There was, you know, rampant sexism within the international brigades. In my book, I tell a story that you don't always actually see in books on the American brigaders, which is the rape of Marion Merriman, who is actually the commander of the brigade's wife and is raped by an officer from, she doesn't say who, of a different nationality, but a brigade's officer, who obviously feels, you know, that he's entitled to this woman. So while there are hundreds and hundreds of women in the brigades, they're mainly working as nurses or administrators. And especially André Marty, who is the head of the brigades, one of the seven secretaries of Comintern, a very important and powerful figure in international communism, you know, is an outright misogynist. And so that's rather tragic. So in that sense, even though there's a wonderful exception, who is Evelyn Hutchinson, who becomes an ambulance and truck driver, an American, and she does get to the front line, and also Gerda Taro as a photographer. She's not a member of the international brigades, but like Capa, sort of embraces the Republican cause, and she also gets to the front line. But otherwise, generally, women were kept out of the fighting, but still did an incredibly important job, you know, in the hospitals and things. And again, you know, we have talking about African Americans, Salaria Key, who was a Black African an African American nurse, and you know, so we have African American women as well present in Spain, in a country which, you know, had no experience or certainly in parts of Spain, no experience of seeing people of African origin at all. And so there was, you know, there's some very interesting encounters between African Americans who actually, in terms of personal wealth and culture and education, are actually, you know, more advanced than the Spaniards they've come to help. And so that produces, you know, situations which are very interesting. And there's an innocence to those encounters that you don't find in other in other situations, simply because, you know, the Spaniards are, you know, they're very poor, they're not very worldly, they're not very experienced, and they just, you know, see the person as a person and are not influenced by, you know, the discourse on race of the 1930s and of, you know, the era of colonialism and empire.
Oh, Giles, we just got about 5 minutes or so here left with you. So I want to get your take on how this war, we know how it turned out, unfortunately, but how did the post-war years, the Franco, the 40-year dictatorship, does that still have an impact on modern Spain? Is there still debate happening, you know, among the descendants of the fighters on both sides?
Yes, there's still a lot of debate going on about that. I mean, just as a very first quick remark, I'd say Yes, in terms of the international brigaders, they lost the war because Franco won and became dictator for 40 years. But in terms of their sort of anti-fascist battle, they actually won that in 1945. And also they won the argument about whether fascism would have to be fought with arms, which of course in 1936, most of the world or most of the Western world didn't agree on. As far as Spain is concerned now, well, you know, Franco died in 1975. Democracy, you know, appeared a few years afterwards. And there was a sort of veil of silence was drawn over the history, both of Francoism and of the Civil War in the first, let's say, two decades of this new Spanish democracy, partly because it was fragile and people just didn't want to go there again. They were scared of their own history. That period is over, and now we're arguing over history, and we're arguing over, some people on the right still think that Franco was right. There was never a period, unlike in other countries like South Africa or in Latin American countries, where there was a sort of period of shaming of the people who had imposed their will on others, or exposing their violence, or putting them on trial. None of that had happened in Spain. So now that means that the sort of the debate didn't happen when it would have been strongest, when memories were strongest, and so it's harder now to fight these opinions of, you know, oh well, it wasn't so bad, and you know, and Spain was in trouble, and etc. And so now we have a socialist government which is introducing a law on historical memory, which will sort of right some of those wrongs, but it's still very tepid in the sense that people are scared of rattling the old cage. But it does mean that, you know, the argument in its fullest sense has not been won, the same argument that the international brigaders were involved in when they were here about defending democracy against fascism and how fascism was the enemy of democracy. That hasn't actually been fully won here, and might not be won because it's too late.
Just here briefly, this history, as we look back, you know, 80 years now, and the echoes that we hear of, like, the inability to accept election results, say in democratic countries, you know, I'm thinking January 6th here, this kind of through line that you see from this historical era to the present. A quick comment about that.
Yes, well, I mean, I'm very sort of, I don't like to draw comparisons between two different historic periods, though I have to say, you know, after January the 6th, I then immediately wrote an article in The Guardian about how it reminded me of a takeover of the Spanish Parliament in 1981, where by Francoists who wanted to turn the clock back and destroy the new democracy. And, you know, and again, it was, you know, I rather facetiously said, you know, men in silly hats, you know, trying to overthrow the elected government. But the only, for me, the only lesson here is that actually history is never proven until events have happened. But that doesn't mean that, just as the international brigaders were supposedly premature anti-fascist, that, you know, that there aren't moments where you have to sort of stand up and be counted and warn of potential dangers that are ahead. You know, what you can't do is the let's call it the moral equivalent of non-intervention, where you go, oh well, you know, it's all okay, nothing terrible has happened. No, you have to remember there are moments where, you know, people have to stand up and say something. And I would say, you know, in the United States, it may well be one of those moments. I'm not American, so I'm not going to, you know, preach to an American audience about this. But in that sense, it's interesting. And of course, it's also very interesting to fascism is a word that gets bandied around and it's sort of slightly abused, I think, in from my sort of, you know, point of view as a historian. But there are threads that go through it that you can see in within various kinds of, you know, new authoritarian regimes. And really, it doesn't have to be full-blown fascism. You have to look out for the different threads, which are dangerous in themselves and, you know, and together can become very dangerous. And, you know, and some of those things, certainly, we're beginning to see.
As Mark Twain was supposed to have said, history doesn't repeat itself, but it does rhyme.
Exactly. Well, who was it? George Santayana, who was a Spaniard in the United States, who said, you know, if you don't know your history, it will repeat itself. I'm more with Twain on that. But yes, exactly. You have to, you know, learn, but not in the sense that, you know, that one thing is going to be repeated, you know, 50, 60, 70, 80 or 100 years later, but that, you know, there are currents and flows which operate in different ways in different periods, but have things in common.
Our guest has been journalist, author, and historian Giles Trimlett. His latest book is The International Brigades, Fascism, Freedom, and the Spanish Civil War, and has been good enough to spend some time with us today. Giles, thanks so much. It was very interesting.
Max, thank you very much indeed. That was a huge pleasure.